Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Biz Dev Podcast, the podcast about developing your business. I'm David Baxter, and I'm your host. I am joined, per usual, by Gary Voigt. Hey, Gary.
Yeah.
How's that Taylor Swift tattoo healing? The one that's all over your back? Did you get that finished?
We were not going to talk about this on the air. Can we edit this out, Noah?
No, man. Be a Swiftie, loud and proud, baby. I know you went to that Era tour like 14 times.
I constantly tease my daughter about Taylor Swift, and she gets so upset. Oh, she's diehard.
No one like admits to being a Swiftie, and yet she makes bazillions of dollars of all these people who are not. That's all I know. I have to say, and I know this is putting a date on this podcast, but I do have tickets to the movie version of her tour. So, yeah. I mean, I don't know if my tattoo needs to dry or what.
I was just going to say, I'll give you the number to my tattoo guy.
Of your tattoo guy? Nice. More importantly, we are joined by Virag Garbjanian, who is the founding partner of Actuatech. Actuate. Did I say that right? Actuate. I said your name right. I worked very hard.
Was super surprised you got his name right first try.
I got his name right.
I lost my breath for a second.
I butchered his company name. So, killer. Go me. I'm a professional. Welcome, Virag. How are you, man?
Doing really great, guys. Good to be on the channel with you guys. And I am really surprised that you pronounced it right. Like, We didn't even practice that.
I will take zero credit. You did a fabulous job on your LinkedIn saying your name.
Ah, so okay. Someone used that.
37 okay. times to get it right. And bam-o, like a pro. And then I butchered the company name. I am on fire. So
it's all good.
Give me the 30,000 foot view. What is Actuate?
Actuate is a management consulting firm. We help two different kinds of companies, usually large organizations with tech partnerships, strategy, innovation, and then with more B2B tech startups is who we serve as well. And it's anywhere from like seed, A, series B, and it's usually go-to-market help, deal coaching, and fundraising.
Okay.
Yeah.
How did that begin? You've been doing it for a couple of years, almost 3 years, it looks like.
Yep.
So how did that come to be? Is that just putting together everything you want? You struck out on your own? Classic consulting?
Yeah, it's a good story. So it was like in the midst of my last startup, Clay, where I was still running, it was an AI company, and I was doing a lot of selling to the larger companies on technology integration work, especially. So this was with AR, VR headsets and smartphones and TVs. I saw the first challenge that made me think of Actuate. And the first challenge was with these big guys, you really want to do partnerships. It's really, really hard for them to get clear on what they're looking for. And it's a broken process that starts to affect both parties involved. So they waste a lot of time of startups time. It's hard for them to get clear within their own larger company with all the stakeholders on what they want. And so the first version or vision of Actuate was supposed to be a technology partnerships as a service company, right? And we started with that, and then we started just seeing like, okay, all these startups keep hitting me up for consulting, and then there's some different asks as well from some of these larger companies. So it's kind of expanded into a little more than that in terms of services, but that's the sort of the genesis.
Okay. It reminds me early on in Big Pixel's life, I was in the stage where I would wash your car if you do my bill rate, right?
Yeah.
And we've all been there. And I was approached by a large university, which I will not say the name. And they were looking for an RFP to rebuild a website. They were a university connecting to a health organization, and they wanted this beautiful website. And it was going to be pretty good size. And they had told me, we have just spent $200,000 a year ago. We'd hired a major firm to build this. And now we don't like it a year later. So we've gotten another $400,000 to rebuild this next website.
Wow.
And I said, okay. So I was coming in and it was just me. Like Big Pixel was literally just me at the time. And so I'm talking to them and going, well, why did you fail? And they're like, I love this. We didn't know what we wanted to build.
Right.
They spent $200,000 and all of their stakeholders, like you said, all wanted something different. Now, in university space, if you've ever worked there, it is fiefdoms. Like those big universities, like each professor has their own little fiefdom, and no one, they are the king of that domain, and no one's allowed in it. And this overarching website crossed lots of them, right? Mm. And so all of these stakeholders had their fiefdoms, and no one could agree because their fiefdom was the winner, and that should be the focus. So they spent $200,000 building this site no one wanted, no one liked. And I said, hey, you know what you need to do? You need to hire me. Of course, I'm selling. You need to hire me instead of doing this RFP thing that you're doing, that you're going to end up with the same situation you're in before. You need to hire me to show you just what you need to build. I'll meet with all the stakeholders. We'll do this. And then you can do whatever. Of course, they did not do any of that thing. They put it out and I lost the bid. But it reminded me, it's like, man, when you have a lot of stakeholders, all cooks, all chefs, you know, no cooks, whatever that horrible analogy that I'm butchering is. It doesn't work in the kitchen. Well. There it is. See? Yeah. Smarter people than I, but it never works. And we've even said that in startups. We've had startups, especially those that do a lot of the competitions and stuff around the area to win money or prestige or whatever. A lot of them have founding teams of like 7 or 8 people. And one of the first advice when we're in mentoring land is, dude, you know what you call something with multiple heads, right? A monster. It doesn't work. And you can't manage this. You got to choose a leader and go, which is of course hard when you're all young people, but I've digressed yet again. So one thing that interests me about your history is your time as well, and you still are, but your past as an angel investor, which to me is a different side of the fence than we see a lot. Most of our guests are startup founders, which you are, but don't have a lot of experience there. So I would love to know a little bit more about that world. I mean, tell me, let's just start at the very beginning. What is an angel investor just at the highest level?
Yeah, that line is getting a little murkier lately, but I see it as kind of non-institutional money. So it's somebody, it's usually an individual who is investing out of their own net worth. Like they haven't set up a separate entity to draw funds from, right? Then one of their own that represents them, right? So they don't have like multiple people investing. It's their own money. I would call that an angel. Typically, those checks are anywhere from as little as, you know, $5,000 to as much as a couple hundred grand. I've seen. It depends on the person and their strategy and their own, you know, amount of wealth that they have. And yeah, we can go into it. But there's kind of pros and cons of dealing with angels. You know, there's trade-offs. I got into it. I wasn't something that I went out and like chased. To be honest, it was just more. You know, in the work that I do, there was just some opportunities that came my way that I looked at and I said, you know, this is interesting enough for me. I either have a personal interest in what they're doing, or I see that there's others that would really want that kind of technology or product as it got more mature. And so I can kind of see down the pike and it's like, okay, you know, especially how it was the last 10 years, it's much more about like, can you see the ramp, right? Can you see them getting to the next funding milestone? And if the answer to that was yes, angel, then the yeah, go ahead.
When you're an angel, the trade-off, the unwritten trade-off is I am taking a ton of risk, right? Because you don't exist most of the time. When people are raising angel, correct me if I'm wrong, but most people I've seen in my world is if you're going for angel, you probably are pre-product or brand new product, right? So that angel is believing in you as a person or your idea so much that they're going to write you a check of various sizes, like you were saying, purely based off of the idea or who you are as a person. Because the chance of success at this point is very low just because of startups and statistics and all of that. So it's usually you get more equity at this stage because of that risk. Is that correct?
That's generally true. Although I think literally quarter over quarter, these dynamics are starting to change, right? So, and maybe even within angels, you can also just draw a line. There's some angels that are, I mean, they're so well connected into certain funds or certain ecosystems that it's more than just like a friends and family, random person who's just an angel, right? I mean, it's like somebody who's like if you get this angel, they know so many other VCs that they will, you know, open doors to. What I meant by the changing dynamics as well is that I feel as if, you know, with this last market correction, it seems like you might even be further along and you would still go collect angel money. So there's okay. So many institutional VCs that have just said either I'm on pause or I'm shifting all my energy to generative AI, that there's a lot of startups that are out there right now trying to figure out, well, how do I get my next check? And whereas there would have been a VC before, now they might be thinking, hey, I need that next million. I'm just stay alive. I might just go get 10 angel checks. Right. And I do have a product and I do have a little more progress than what you had mentioned. So,
and I assume you on the angel side, are you hearing this all the time? Are you asking these questions? Like, okay, they all say AI. Are you digging in at all to see if there is?
Yeah. I mean, in my case, the stuff that I tend to see is a little bit more deep tech. Sure. So what that means is it's either someone who is like innovating within those large language models and trying to make that better in some way or differentiated, or it's somebody at least who is using those large language models as a core part of their product. Like they're really leaning hard. And you brought a couple examples of that up. And I'm pretty aligned with you guys that it is overhyped and it necessarily needs to be right now because people have a lot of dry powder still and they're trying to figure out where to put it. And here's like something that actually is a little bit, in my opinion, compared to all the other technologies that we've seen over the last decade, you know, come and go. I feel like it's one of the few that's actually hit an end consumer and they're using it. Now, it doesn't mean it's as big as everyone's purporting it to be, but people are using a form of a large language model right now at a fast growing rate. So that's exciting.
It's exciting. For
it's sure. exciting. But it does need to be something that at the end of the day, going back to more product principles, right? It needs, for me listening to it, it needs to be something that I look at and say, hey, it's solving a problem for the end customer in some unique way because of that, right? Or it's, and some people are just betting on it, like taking away some of the friction for a customer and using a product. Great. Show me that, right? But of the overall value delivered to the customer from a product, I think it's a piece. I don't think it's necessarily the whole thing, right?
I agree with that. I think
it's a piece of it, right? So it's a nice, I see it as like, you still need a nice train on a train track and this is some nice oil for you to use, right? But you still need a train on a train track. That's a horrible analogy, but you get the point. it's oil.
It's a nice bonus feature
that
helps, but it's not the feature. It's not the main
product. And I can see it being used in useful ways in almost every business.
Yes.
But for the most part, the people who are trying to do it aren't in that deep tech world. They're just trying to use ChatGPT in some fun way. And that's cool, but it's not what anybody's going to give you money for, or shouldn't be.
Why someone's giving you money.
I mean, I guess now it probably is. If you don't have AI, people aren't interested. But, and I get that man, what a tough needle thread to needle. I don't need, man, I'm killing my analogies today. Needle to thread.
No, you're great. These are awesome. Totally won't make fun of
it. It is gold, everybody. Gold. These should be my new t-shirts.
Threading the macaroni.
Yeah,
it's tough because you need that money to keep going, like you're saying. And those people are telling you, those investors are telling you, I want to get into AI, which is basically code for if you make it yours AI, I will write you this check right here. So they're all sneaking it in some silly way. Yeah. And they did that before with crypto. We would get, when I was mentoring and stuff, we would get pitches, everything at crypto and NFT, blockchain. Smart contracts. Oh, yes. Gonna change the world. Has it? Anybody changed their world today based off smart contracts? No. I think in 5 years, AI, what I think will be really interesting in 5-10 years, AI will be everywhere. We just won't be talking about it.
Right. let me flip a question to you guys. Do you guys use any form of and let's be specific about the kind of AI we're talking about. There's a lot of different forms of AI. In this case, I think we're talking about generative AI. Do you guys use generative AI day to day? If so, how often?
I do not. Okay. I will let Gary speak for himself. Our team uses it every day when they're coding. The wow. Copilot tools
okay.
wow. are built in, and they, and I have to say, I'm using it in, when I code a little bit, like it'll fill in things and do things. It's your IntelliSense is on crack now. It's really, really good. And it saves you a lot of typing. But like some of my guys, I code only some of my time, but some of my full-time guys, they will be like, hey, they'll pull up a chat bar, which ones mm-hmm. they use just depends. And they'll say, hey, I need code this. And it'll go, and it'll throw up. Now it's not great code, but it saves them a lot of typing, right? So that's right. being used a lot.
Yeah.
What I will, like some of our guys, I asked them the same question. And one of my guys says, I don't use search engines anymore. I put it all into ChatGPT because I find the answers to be more actionable than the 30 minutes that I would need to comb through the, I haven't done that yet, even though I feel like I need to, yeah. I feel like I need to jump off of this thing and figure all that out. Cause I have a team license for my guys to use ChatGPT to play with it.
Cool.
But that is as far as I go. Gary, how are you using it? If at all?
I use it as a supplemental, on my side, since I'm not coding, I'm doing more of the design stuff. I'll use ChatGPT for help with like anything from creating like a user flow, a user profile, all the way to just some generate marketing copy for me to kind of start with. And I can say, like, right. give me, you know, these five topics, give me some hero section copy, and then imagine features for this and that. Just so I'll have something more than lorem ipsum to start with, and then I'll be able to expand upon it like that. I do use Adobe Firefly for image generation. I have not actually generated an image that I'm comfortable using, but it is fun to play with. Like, it'll get close to what I envision and of what it could be, but there's always that small amount of like, okay, this looks close to what I'm actually trying to pull off. How can I change this prompt to make it, you know, 90% there instead of the 70 or 80% that it is. And then the amount of time spent trying to, you know, tweak that prompt to get what you want. After a while, you're just like, this is a waste of time. I could have already right. like, built this in a 3D right. program. So yes. it's great for a prompt or not a prompt, but it's a good starting place for the things that I do, but it's not good enough to be a finisher. Like,
agreed. All. Yeah. I could see that.
How about you? But how much do you use it?
I use it, a lot now. It used to be once every like 2 weeks. But then what was funny was I kept the window open, let's just say with ChatGPT, and I started realizing, like, oh, I can use it for this and then that. And then I started replacing Google searches with it, right? And then I started realizing that, to Gary's point, at least for now, it is really only as good as you prompt it. And then so having the right prompts is kind of part of the IP of what you do, how you use it, right? So if, going back to the technology startups who want to use this right in some way, I think it's like if you just think you're going to add some ChatGPT-like widget or chatbot into your product and think you've got something differentiated, like no one cares anymore, right?
No one cares.
But if you use it as part of your product flow, in some way that, again, takes away some of the friction or makes it easier to use or keeps the customer coming back, and it's prompted in the right way and it's context specific and you've bounded it so it's not, you know, hallucinating and saying stupid things. Now, maybe you overall have a better product than the guy who's not using it, right? Or the gal. So that becomes interesting. But, you know, to your point, David and Gary, a lot of people don't say it that way. They just kind of tack it on and hope for the best. And I don't think that wins.
What I think it can do, not yet, but I think the promise that I see in it, and this is just one of the many areas, but like I give, for instance, Apple, right? I wear all the gizmos and doodads. It has a lot of data on me, my health data. Let's just do the rings, right?
Oh, man.
I've been closing yeah. rings forever. I'm about to, 1750, I think is my current mark that I'm aiming at. I close those a lot. That's a ton of data. What does Apple tell me to do with that data? How do they improve my health? None. Zero zip. It's, did you close your ring? Did you stand enough? Did you do anything today? That's all they care about. The companies that figure out how to use all of this quantified data, not just self, but it all over the place. In every app, you're collecting data. when you can take that app and apply AI and say, now that I have this raw data, I can use that data to now analyze it and tell you an action plan, whatever. That to me is something AI can do. And when they figure that out, when people in startups figure, okay, I'm collecting all this data, now I'm going to use AI to apply and give it, that's where you're going to have startups that just explode, because no one's been able to do that in 50 years. Like, that is, we've been stuck. We got it. We collect it. We have it all. What? And I'll sell it. That's as far as we've gotten with data right now, right? Everyone just sells it. Oh, someone's going to do something with it. And eventually, you know, where AI is being used a ton is which ads you're going to see whenever you're looking. That's, they're very good at that, right? They're creepily good at what ads you should see next. I want to see that in other startups. I want to see that in, you know, LinkedIn as a cheesy example to say, hey, you should get connected with this guy because of these reasons. You need to, you guys would be able to do business together. AI can do that stuff.
And like put a plan of how you might work together too, something like that.
Yeah.
Right? Some recommendation. Yeah.
I know what you do. I know what he does. He's posting over here. He's in Colorado. I don't see him. He's posting about the need for custom software. Boom. I'm a sales navigator person, right? I'm paying for that. And so boom, we're going to connect you to, or think you should. Hey, do you think this might be a thing? He was just asking about what you do for a living. Maybe you should reach out. Oh my gosh. I mean, how much money would I just fork out for that? But, and this is a cheesy example, but that's where it's going to be exciting. Not, is it writing my email well? I don't know. Do I mean, now I can tell when it's AI written for the most part.
That too.
AI images, they all look a certain way.
That gap between, like, AI is going to take over and make us obsolete and everybody's worried about it, to 5 minutes later, everybody's like, that's obviously done by AI. That's not worth it. You know, like, that scary gap got closed real quick.
It's the uncanny valley. Humans from birth are trained to recognize humans. And we are very, very good. Everyone, every human on the planet is very good at looking at you and going, you look like a human. Anything that breaks that is creepy. It's immediately creepy. Our fight or flight starts flaring up, right? Oh, I don't know what this is. And you don't like it. You don't trust it. It's now something I'm going to back away from, which is the thing you need to be worried about if you are that startup. Because if you can't cross that line, it's like the old, I'm a big gamer. If the old video game eyes, the old movie eyes, when those look dead inside, no one wants to watch that movie. Super creepy. And Polar Express being the classic example. Sweet movie, but dude, they're all zombies running around Santa. You know, it's whoa. Same thing for AI. I still am fascinated. And the fundraising stuff, that side of it, because we don't hear much of that. What is it, if you're looking at, I'm thinking a small thing, $25,000 or less, right? Mm. A startup comes up to you, pitching their idea. What are you as a potential, say you haven't worked with them. I know most of your people you're investing in, you know them from a deep level because of your Actuate and all that good stuff. Yep. Take that, put that to the side for a moment.
Sure.
Guy comes up to you. What is it that's going to check the boxes for you to invest, to give, write that $25,000 check?
I don't think I do anything too different from the standard check boxes that people have out there. Like,
what are those standards? Because I don't think most of the people in our audience aren't going to know those standards.
Okay. Yeah, they're probably even too afraid to go down the fundraising route at this point. So,
okay.
I mean, pre-revenue, that's fine for you. Generally speaking, that's cool, right?
Yeah, I mean, for angel investing is still predominantly that, right? It's still pre-revenue, right? But you want to see that they are going after a market that's growing and big enough. And so to get a little bit more specific there, it's not just some report, it's some addressable market. Hey, we're going after these kinds of businesses in the United States, or this kind of size. This is the number of them that are out there. And we're going to, you know, charge them this amount for this product that we have. We're solving this problem. It is I like to use the Y Combinator language. It's like a recurring and urgent problem. There's an unmet need. The people that are addressing it are doing it in this way, right? And so there's still something that's missing. And we're going to attack it with this kind of product. And that product, what I like to look for in that early of a stage is that that founder product market fit. It's like all three, right? It's like, okay, you starting from the market growing, there's still an unmet need. It's a cool, interesting product for it. Awesome. But then I'm going to look at like, who's telling me about it? Like, have they done something like that before? Do they know the people that they're trying to go win business with? If that's like out of whack in the earliest days, it's like, I don't have the risk appetite for it.
Yeah.
Another angel investor might. Right. But I'm looking for that kind of really strong alignment. For me, again, this is not typical of other angels. Other angels may do this, but I won't invest if it's not in my scope of knowledge. Like if I don't have, you know, my own understanding of what that problem is and like I can relate to it or I know the people who have it, it's too risky for me. But there could be folks that are, they love angel investing more or they have way more money where like, you know, they'll invest in things they don't understand. Right.
Sure.
Not me. The way I allocate, that's the thing about an angel investor is like the allocation is different for each one, right? Like someone might just be like, hey, all the money I would have normally invested in other more risky things in my portfolio, I'm doing only in angel investing. So they have more appetite, right? And I think what's happened recently is, you know, the stock market got so cheap that a lot of angels, including me, in some capacity were like, you know what? These are like known entities, right? Mm-hmm. That have great businesses that the price of which has fallen. Like now I get to choose between that and something from the ground up. So these are always adjustments that every investor is making, and the angel can make them even faster because they're an angel, they're not institutional.
What? It is a common belief that in order to get any sort of investment, angel or otherwise, you need to be targeting unicorn status. If you're going to, you know, the end goal that you're not going after $1 billion valuation eventually, that no one's going to give you money. True or false?
True. If the angels you're targeting are the ones who are hoping for a follow-on round with VCs, right? VCs are oriented that way. And I think the majority of angels that are out there are trying to stay on that path, right? Where they're looking for, I want to cut this check and I want the institutional VC investor to get in afterwards and mark up the value. And no institutional VC is going to get in unless they see that kind of $1 billion outcome. Now there's two caveats. One is I think the market is cooled off enough /corrected, whatever you want to call it, where institutional money is rethinking, I think their portfolio. And do they really want to still have the same mindset of, I need one unicorn per 15 companies I invest in? Maybe we're okay with, you know, a few base hits that don't need to be a unicorn, right? So I think that's actively being decided now. And then, of course, there are always angels that are like looking to invest in something that like is a little bit more sure that is not a venture backable thing. It's just a small business or more of a lifestyle business that could one day exit for sure much less, but at a predictably higher probability. Right. So that exists too. But I don't think that's the majority. Yeah.
Are there angels that, let's say you are building a super niche lifestyles type business, right? Software. And you know, when you're up and running, you're Tam and Sam and all that good stuff, you're probably going to be $1 million or $2 million in revenue, mm-hmm. right? Good living, going to be a small team. As a lifestyle business, you'd be wealthy by most standards. You'd be, sure. It'd be really great. But in order to do this, this lady needs to get $100,000, $50,000, something around, not million, $100,000 is a great idea, whatever. Is that as a no-go and you're going to tell them, hey, you know, friends and family, maybe a bank loan, but I'm not it. Is that what most angels are going to say to that person?
I think so.
Okay.
Yeah, I think so.
It's just not big. But I mean, that's, you're saying, but say the idea is great, right? And it's an untapped market, but it's small, super niche. The surety is much higher, right? Because she's tackling something great. And the return, you give $50,000, you're going to get, say, profit sharing for 10 years, I'm making this up, and you're going to turn that $50,000 into $300,000. Six times, any investment over 10 years, that would be insane. But you're saying most, you know, almost all that you would know of would say, probably not. That's two small potatoes. That's what I'm curious about. Is it the small potatoes that just killed it?
I think for the, like I said, it is changing a little bit now, right?
Sure.
But traditionally, the idea of the angel investor, so many of them were so closely tied to like that track of venture money, right? Yeah. But there's a good amount of them out there. I don't know as many of them, but there's a good amount of them out there that will do checks for those lifestyle businesses. I think certainly are. I don't think people have done a good job maybe putting those kinds of options together, you know, or maybe I'm so deep in like technology innovation world that like I don't come across it as often. Very possible, right?
Well, I don't see that in the mentoring land either. One of the things that always frustrated me for doing this in the last 10 years is you have two paths. You are lifestyle and worthless, or you are billionaire bound and I want to talk to you.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. Like lifestyle is poo-poo, go away. You are not worth my time. Even though that's what most small business is, let's be honest, the vast, vast majority. But it's like in colleges around here, I mean, we have tons of colleges in North Carolina, and all the accelerators of any sort, if you're not billionaire bound, they want nothing to do with you. And I'm like, man, that just really irks me because some of the best businesses you're ever going to find are never going to be more than $2 or $3 million in revenue ever, but they are taking great care of their customers. The founder is, you know, living sweet, living a great life. He's not eating ramen noodles on the while everyone's mad at him because he owes so much money. I've just always, like you said, I wish there was something for those people because I mean I guess there is. They call them banks, I suppose. but a bank doesn't invest in technology like that. That's super risky for them.
So I'll add to the problem. I mean, there is companies that come up for sale now that you guys may or may not have heard of, acquire.com, Andrew Gazdecki's company. There's a few different websites that have been popping up where you can kind of post the business for sale. And let's say it's doing exactly what you just said. It's doing 50K a month or it's doing 100K a month, right? And they've been running it for 3 years. For whatever reason it is, they want to sell. If you want to be a buyer in that kind of company, like if it's not something that has physical assets behind it, no bank's going to touch it.
Yeah.
Right. So it's just, so where are those angel investors? Right. I mean, it's a similar question, right? It's like, why won't you pick this thing up that, I mean, it could be a great business, like everything you just described, like it's got pretty secure customers. Mm-hmm. It's not a fast growing market, but it's solving a problem. It's small, right? It's a small business, but a bank won't touch it because it's software, right? And like they're like, oh, there's no collateral.
Go get
there's no collateral on this. So it's kind of I've been in those situations where I've looked at them and I've thought of maybe buying them myself, but then when I look at like financing options, it just doesn't exist.
Yeah.
Right. And so then you're gonna go rich. Talk to the same angels on a let's say $4 million business where they go, oh, why don't you just start it from scratch and build something that could be $1 billion or more, right? So it's interesting.
That's so funny. Like, I think that discounts what that founder did, right? To take a company from zero to 4 million in revenue.
Hardest part.
Oh my goodness. Yeah. As a guy who's not even at $4 million in revenue, let me tell you, that is hard. It is, and discount, you could just start your own. Like that is so, you are so out of touch at that point. It's like the rapper saying, the first billion's the hardest. Oh, shut up. I mean, come on, man. It's just, it's frustrating because that person has a skill set, that founder, to take a business from zero to a million, let's say, is a skill set that is so rare because they didn't die. They weren't part of that 80% that died in the first 2 years. He's not in the other 90% who doesn't get up to a million or two in revenue. Like that percentage of that founder, that guy or girl who gets up to 2 million in revenue is like 0.1% of people who have that skill set and tenacity to do that. And you're just saying, I could just start that up. It's not a problem. I don't get up for less than $10 million. Oh, come on. just drive, that stuff drives me nuts. I'm sorry. I'm on a soapbox. It happened again.
But I think it's, David, I think it's changing. That's my point. I think it's something that people realize, like, kind of part of the economy we were in over the last 10 years. And, you know, I mean, there was a lot more of an infrastructure for people who were trying to go from, who were shooting for that $1 billion outcome, right? Mm-hmm. There's just so many companies that got funding over the last several years.
Stupid
money,
yeah.
That were given a chance to do that, and most still won't make it, but at least they're, you know, getting paid well enough to keep trying, right? And keep pushing. Now that I think that some of that is not as readily available, let's say that way, people are going to be more open to a different model. Like, they don't have to have a $1 billion outcome for some success, right? I think that that's going to be something that will be more common going forward.
I have a question that's a little bit of a tangent, but it's more related to your company's services. Mm-hmm. So,
fine.
Out of the companies that you do consult for, big or small, but I'm basically asking about the newer ones, the startup ones. One of the services you provide is like marketing consulting. We have found it extremely hard to try to find the startups to market to because they don't exist yet for our services. What are the kind of marketing services that you suggest newer companies and smaller startups like apply to get them known, to go from being in that slog where no one knows about them to having a little bit of gravity to pull in customers based on their reputation?
So I don't usually provide like marketing services for the startups that I work with, in the sense that I don't do like, or I don't execute for it for them. Like, I won't do any like, you know, LinkedIn marketing or anything like that, right? What I do help them with is thinking through the marketing strategy, maybe, but keep in mind the companies that I tend to deal with are like B2B deep tech. And sometimes it looks like we've got this amazing, let's say, XR application, and we're thinking through what markets we can hit with it and maybe trying to still find product market fit. And in that case, it's like, okay, let's look at the potential markets, a little more strategic and kind of business strategy, and do some customer okay. development and up and up those doors, you know? So I don't know if that answers your question, but it's a little bit of a different scope.
Based on your experience, what would three pieces of advice be that you would give to a small business or an entrepreneur or someone you've just invested in to try to get to the level of success that you see them getting to?
What I see is that a lot of founders forget that at the end of the day, especially if they're doing something more B2B, it is really about sales early on. And it's a word that no one likes, you know, because they have jaded kind of opinions about it and where that word comes from, what they've seen. But, you know, in my world, I see a lot of people coming from really sophisticated, amazing backgrounds and different disciplines or functions. They've had a lot of success. And what they tend to forget or underestimate is that when they decide to take that leap and start a company, then the first point is actually just trying to make a sale. And that is something that a lot of sort of sales native people that like grew up doing sales will tell you, but I'm someone who's come like backed my way into that, understanding that, right? I didn't start off as like, oh, my first job was sales or something. I just realized that. I've learned that myself. And I think that's really important for them to know. So, pick up a couple books on it. It's not rocket science, but just like get decent at it. That's going to really, really help in the early stages. The other thing I would do is keep in mind that if you're doing something new, if you're trying to be innovative and change the status quo, even on a micro level, you're most likely going to be wrong in what that is, or people are not going to accept that change or don't want it. There will be resistance. Most of the time it's because you thought you had a good idea and like you don't, right? But every now and then you'll be right. Maybe one out of every five, six times, right? So if you're trying to be, you know, a full-time entrepreneur your whole career, bake that into your plans and recognize that, like, you want to iterate and test as quickly as you can. Having other people's money to do that can help accelerate it, but realize now you're burning other people's money. But, like, being really good at testing the hypothesis in some analytical way and getting through those different great ideas, that's a good thing, right? And, like, don't stick too long to one. It shouldn't be so much resistance, right? So that's another thing to keep into account. A third is, let's see. This is one that I've learned that's so important. It's who you work with is, like, probably as important as almost anything else. And I think this gets true as you get older, right? Like, who you decide to spend your time around, if you're going to do something like starting a company, like, it's good to pick great people to be around, because as things are, you know, likely going to go wrong at times, you're going to have ups and downs. It's kind of who you pick to do that with, where, like, don't, like, that's like, people say it's like getting married. It kind of is true, but you want to have fun and during the process, right? And you want to be able to, like, get through the lows. So pick someone you want to do it with. And I would say, like, if you don't have these things set up, if you're at a company right now and you're trying to, like, leave and go to start something, I think it's really wise for you to know who you would do it with and at least an idea to start. Like, if you don't know who you want to do it with, like, you have to be a very specific kind of person to go ahead and, like, do that alone, you know, for an extended period of time. And that's, if you are that person, great, go for it. But, like, know that if you haven't done a lot of stuff on your own before and been through a lot of ups and downs, pick someone to do it with. It's going to be a lot better. So those are my three bits of advice.
Those are good. Yeah. If you're doing it alone, you're basically just a freelancer. So,
yeah.
I've said it before. When I started Big Pixel, everyone asked if I was doing freelancing because I was alone. I was doing my thing, writing code. Sure. And I would tell them, no, I'm just my first employee. And that was a huge mindset for me. Like, I didn't want to just fill my bucket like a freelancer would. It's, oh, I'm working 40 hours a week. I'm killing it. Let's go. I wanted to fill my bucket and then find someone else to fill their bucket and find someone else and do that.
Nice.
Yeah. That's a big mind shift. And I took that early because that's where I wanted to go. It was like kind of like vision casting, using the cheesy word, but trying to get there. Because otherwise you get complacent. Oh, I'm full. I'm busy enough. I'm good. And we work with those people. Like, we have contractors. We work with them all the time. And, you know, they fill their bucket and they're done. It's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. But that wasn't my path. So.
Sure. Yeah, there is a difference. It's good to know what you want, you know, earlier than later in that way.
Now, if anyone wants to find out more about you or your company, what would be the best places for them to go explore?
So to connect with me, I think LinkedIn is great. It's really easy to find me because I got, like, one of the hardest names out there. It's an Armenian name.
But you have a great description on how to say your name on LinkedIn too. So
as I've been told,
he does. If you just need to add your company,
try it again, David.
Just fine.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then the other is the company website. It's actuatetech.io, and there's things that we're constantly, like, iterating and adding there on the services and who, you know, what we provided to whom and all that. So that's going to be kind of learn a little bit more. But to connect with me, my LinkedIn's probably best. I'm on it all the time.
Okay, we'll put those links into the show notes as well. So,
cool. Thanks, guys.
Well, this has been an absolute pleasure to chat with you, man. I have enjoyed it. I'm sorry for all the tangents, but usually that means I'm enjoying the conversation more.
Yeah, no, it's fun.
If Gary's it's talking, so it usually means I'm bored.
Yeah, if you ever let me talk. No, I was going to say, though, it's interesting to get the perspective of someone from the other side as an investor instead of someone looking for investments. So that was really enlightening. I appreciated that.
Cool. Yeah. I mean, I'm not like by any means the world's best investor, but I've studied the principles a bit enough, and I've been around all the other, you know, VCs and seen the way that they think quite a bit. And I'm in touch with many of them, like my colleagues from grad school now, you know, active venture capitalists are partners at some of the best firms, you know, so I get to see the way that they think. And then, you know, kind of bring some of that back to the startups I work with. So it's cool.
Awesome. Well, helpful thank you insights. Again for joining us, man.
Yeah, absolutely. Great to talk, travel with you guys.
All right. We are out and we will talk to you all next week. Have a good one.
Hi, I'm Christy Pronto, Content Marketing Director here at Big Pixel. Thank you for listening to this episode of the BizDev Podcast. We'd love to hear from you. Shoot us an email, hello@thebigpixel.net. The BizDev Podcast is produced and presented by Big Pixel. See you next week. Until then, follow us on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, Threads, YouTube, and LinkedIn.